Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease. In a moment, the rise and rise of Chinese science.
China science is really just going one way, and that way is just up and up and up. China is now coming out on top, ahead of the US, ahead of the EU. There is going to come a time where the West may not be the sort of dominant force in science.
And the ups and downs of living things. Kew Gardens' stinky Titan Arum that pongs to heaven once in 7 years.
Oh, okay, that's... yeah. Imagine a lavatory that no one's cleaned for a long time. Or just something that's been left at the back of the fridge and just kind of...
has been forgotten.
Yeah, that's bad.
Also, a mass gathering of periodical cicadas crawling out of the soils of North America.
I have never seen so many cicadas come out at one time like that. They were crawling up trees by the hundreds, and it wasn't stopping. I describe this as biblical.
Keep listening. China has become a scientific superpower, declares a feature in The Economist magazine. It's a claim, the article highlights, that couldn't be made just 5 years ago. But now, according to some metrics, the story cites 6 or 7 of the world's top 10 research institutions are in China. The country's Chang'e 6 robotic space mission, returning right now from the moon with samples collected from the far side, is one example of their capabilities. But there are many more. Ainsley Johnston, science editor of The Economist, explained her headline.
Measuring the quality of a country's science is really quite difficult. But there are a few different measures that we can look at. One of them is the number of papers that are what we call high impact. So papers that are really heavily cited by other scientists in their subsequent work. And another measure that people look at is something called the Nature Index, which is a measure of a country's contributions to a set of prestigious journals. And on both of those measures, China is now coming out on top, ahead of the US, ahead of the EU, and they've really had a remarkable rise in the past few years on both of these metrics.
And the story in the past has often been that the big ideas have come from America or from Europe and elsewhere, and what happens in China is sort of practical, how to turn that into some kind of machine or something. But that's absolutely not the story today, is it?
To some extent, that is still the story. So China's particularly producing a huge amount of work in areas like chemistry, physics, material science, and plants and agricultural sciences. So those are things that sort of lend themselves to having more practical applications. But some of that work is certainly, you know, what we might call more pure or basic science as well.
Well, I was thinking of the return of their lunar mission, just it's on its way back right now to the other side of the moon, which is a sort of everything packed into one, trying to find out things about planetary history from the deep past, testing technologies and so on.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, it's also just a huge sort of show of scientific force as well, that you're able to sort of conduct this mission, land on the sort of difficult, hard to reach parts of the moon, scoop up some rock, plant a flag, and then zoom off back to Earth again.
You know, I guess back in the 1960s, it was a way that the United States demonstrated its scientific and engineering prowess, and it's sort of being done instead nowadays, it seems, particularly by China.
I mean, I think that there's a lot of programs that China has that are falling into this category where it's really, you know, big, showy, huge infrastructure projects that the West just really can't help but take notice of. There's certainly some kind of question marks over whether some of the science that China's doing is really, you know, the most useful stuff, or whether it's just the stuff that sort of looks the best.
I mean, this does come on the back of, I think, some pretty determined investment, both in the infrastructure and in the people.
Yeah, a huge amount of investment. The Chinese Communist Party has had science on its radar for a long time and has known that it really wants to improve its science capabilities. And they've sort of picked out key areas where they know they want to really excel, things like AI, semiconductors. And once they've picked out these areas, they're really investing really heavily in them, getting the sort of best infrastructure, really filling universities with loads of equipment, and also paying researchers really good salaries, which I think for a lot of Chinese scientists who had maybe gone abroad are really feeling drawn back.
There's a phrase you used in the article I've not come across before. Was it returning turtles? Have I got that right?
Sea turtles, yeah.
Sea turtles, yeah.
So for years and years, there's been a big outflow of scientists from China. So people have been going abroad to study in the US or in Europe. And recently, lots of them have been coming back to China, sort of drawn by these incentives. The idea is that these sea turtles are sort of bringing back with them on their backs this knowledge and this experience that they've sort of accumulated overseas, and they're sort of bringing it back to China.
One of the interesting aspects of this drive has been, as I understand it, they've had a lot of incentives for Chinese scientists to publish in Western journals, like in Nature and Science and some of the other top league journals.
They definitely have, and partly that seems to have worked quite well for them. But there's also been some problems created by some of these really big incentives. So just recently, there was a paper published which had interviewed Chinese scientists, and several of them had said that this pressure to really produce a lot of high-impact papers and to publish in these big journals was sort of driving them to overblow their results or even fake their results. So there's that side of things. Another thing that scientists are really incentivized to do is to have their work be highly cited and sort of very impactful. And there have also been reports that in order to sort of drive up these metrics, some scientists will sort of band together in what they call citation cartels, which sounds very ominous, but it's where scientists will cite their friends' work, and that will kind of inflate this measure of impact. But it's hard to know how much of this fraud and malpractice is sort of driving these results. It doesn't seem possible that it can be the sort of sole reason that China's really flying up the league tables, but you know, it's definitely something to consider.
How is this impacting scientists in the West? Put it another way, are scientists in the West actually sort of engaging with this kind of science, and are they engaging in the right way?
There is and has always been a huge amount of collaboration between countries, and China's no exception. But in recent years, as sort of geopolitical tensions have risen between China and the West, this has affected science too. I think particularly for researchers who are working in fields where, you know, there could be potentially some sort of sensitive side to their research, there's a lot of uncertainty about how they should be engaging with China or whether they should be engaging with China. But Chinese scientists are extremely happy to collaborate and really want to collaborate with the West.
So that's interesting. I mean, because science is sort of inherently international, but so much of technology has national and military implications. And I suppose those two things don't sit well together.
No, you know, there are these worries that in improving their capabilities in quantum or in sonar, that, you know, that could sort of feed into military capabilities. And for a lot of people, that's quite worrying.
I guess it would be about 20, 25 years ago, I remember talking to economic journalists about how fast the Chinese economy was growing, and that it would no longer be a client, shall we say, sort of nation, but it would be driving the world economy. And it sort of feels a bit the same with science, and there's nothing wrong in that, but you know, it seems like Europe and America should not assume that where they lead, science follows. It could be that there's going to be a shift in the center of balance.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in some ways, I guess it's kind of inevitable that as countries, you know, whether it's China or India and a lot of other countries sort of develop and become sort of richer, they're going to improve their science capabilities. I think that there's still ways that China's science is a bit behind the West. So in terms of the sort of average quality of papers, China's papers are still a sort of a little bit lower quality on average. But China science is really just going one way, and that way is just up and up and up. And I think there is going to come a time where the West may not be the sort of dominant force in science anymore.
Ainsley Johnston of The Economist. One example of China's ambitions is its plans to build a high-energy particle collider like CERN's Large Hadron Collider in Europe, where they discovered the Higgs, only far bigger and far more powerful, and They want to do it far quicker than CERN's own plans for a giant future circular collider. Gemma Conroy has written about China's concept for Nature magazine.
So China is planning to build the circular electron-positron collider. It's not approved by the government just yet, but if it does get approved next year, they will start building this 100-kilometre giant underground accelerator. To put that size in perspective, the Large Hadron Collider is only 27 kilometres in diameter. So, this is a gargantuan machine, a huge particle smasher. CERN's already got its plans to build another sort of successor to the Large Hadron Collider. It would be similar to the CPC in China, be about 91 kilometres. It's called the Future Circular Collider, and that's still pending government approval. So there's a little bit of a race here to see who will get to build this giant particle smasher first.
Did I hear you right? You said if it gets approval, they plan to build it in 3 years.
Yeah, hopefully starting from 2027 if all goes to plan.
This is going to be in an underground tunnel, a bit like the LHC is at CERN. So they've got to dig at least 100 kilometres of mud out from underground. Then they've got to fill it with all the kind of fancy equipment and all that. And it sounds unbelievably ambitious.
Yes, it's staggering, really. I mean, I know the team aiming to sort of publish an engineering design report by the end of this year, which will detail how exactly they're going to do it. And so it's kind of looking like, based on this latest report, which looked at the accelerator, I mean, if they wanted to build the accelerator, they could. But yeah, huge effort. It's mind-boggling to think, you know, how would you build like a 100-kilometre deep underground tunnel for smashing particles together?
You know, one reason I wanted to talk to you about this, about your report, is that this is not, you know, sort of mundane science. This isn't just making a better solar panel or anything. This is at the cutting edge of high-energy physics, understanding the stuff of the universe.
Yes, definitely. It can't get much more fundamental than this. So the biggest goal of the CPC and CERN's FCC, the competing collider, is to study the Higgs boson particle in more detail, and it basically gives all other particles their mass. But there's still a lot we don't really understand about it, and in order to sort of do that, we need to sort of generate huge volumes of Higgs bosons to sort of get a bit more of an idea of how they interact with other particles and the mechanisms behind, you know, how they confer mass to all other particles in the universe. So, yeah, this is heady stuff, for sure.
Did you get a sense of why they want to do this?
I think China is looking to be the next global scientific superpower. The government's always like prioritised basic research, scientific research. They tend to invest a lot more into research than, you know, a lot of other countries.
As an illustration of that, I think there is one other facility that you went to see quite recently, which is another of these high-end, highfalutin physics experiments.
Yes, yes. So I visited the Jiangmen Underground Neutrino Observatory. You go there and the surroundings are so sort of rural and quiet, and then you go underground and there's this giant sphere that's made out of an acrylic kind of material. And this thing will be detecting neutrinos. That will be the main goal. Like, neutrinos are so, they're very ghostly, kind of slippery particles. No one's ever been able to sort of directly observe them. And in order to do that, you need to go underground because their signals are so faint. You know, they tend to be drowned out by signals from other particles, like just constantly flowing through the universe.
So you've really seen, as it were, the determination to do this kind of work.
Yeah, I mean, I went there and these people just don't stop working. People work around the clock, but they've nearly finished it, and by the end of the year they're aiming to sort of start doing experiments. So I think it's be really exciting. I think it's going to be the largest neutrino detector in the world once it's finished.
Gemma Conroy, Asia and Pacific editor for Nature. A reminder, this is Science in Action from the BBC World Service. And so on to two stories of periodical emergencies. First, the periodical cicadas of North America, which have breeding cycles of either 13 or 17 years. Their grubs spend most of that time underground, sucking sap from the roots of trees, only to emerge in massive coordinated swarms for a few brief weeks to breed, to lay eggs, and for a new generation to return to the darkness of the soil. This year has been particularly anticipated as two different broods, numbers 13 and 19, on different cycles have coincided, though not all in the same part of the American Midwest, thankfully. And though Gene Kritsky has been studying these bugs all his academic life, he still finds the spectacle spectacular.
There was one night I got a call from a colleague who basically said, "You've got to come see this. I have never seen so many cicadas come out at one time like that. They were crawling up trees by the hundreds, and it wasn't stopping." I describe this as biblical. Well, 2 days later, when we got all the recording gear and stuff in the car, the clouds opened up, and we must have had 1 to 2 inches of rain in less than an hour. And when it finally stopped raining, the sun peeked out, we get out of our vehicles, and there are thousands of cicadas all over the ground because the rain was so hard, it broke through their tunnels. And my colleague says, "So if the other one was biblical, what's this?" Said, "This is the second coming."
And in any one neighborhood, how long does it last for?
Well, once they start emerging, it'll last for about 6 weeks because it takes 2 weeks for all of them to come out of the ground. And the average cicada, if they're not eaten by predators, will live for about 4 weeks. So those last ones that emerge after 2 weeks, they'll be around for another four. So you have about a 6 week window to enjoy the emergence.
Noisy, is it? You know, I've heard recordings, but they never really carry the sense of it.
They don't. Although this year I visited brood 19 in central Illinois. The highest I measured this year was 102 decibels for brood 19. But to put that in perspective, that's significantly greater than jets flying into Heathrow to land. Imagine that going on for hours and never stopping.
And this is because they crawl out the ground, they got these few weeks to mate, lay the next lot of eggs. I can't remember what happens, but somehow they go down into the soil and the next cycle starts.
Yeah, the eggs, after they're laid, they hatch in about 6 to 10 weeks after they've been laid, and they crawl out of the egg nest and literally just skydive down to the ground. They get underground in less than a minute. Most of them are gone within 30 seconds because they are extremely vulnerable to beetles, ants, spiders when that happens. And so they've got to get themselves protected quickly. They feed on grass roots for a few weeks, and then by New Year's Day, they'll be 8 to 10 inches below the surface sucking on a tree root, which is where they'll be for the next 17 or 13 years.
These different broods, the last time I spoke to you about this, you said that part of the sort of the strategy of these creatures is just to come out in such numbers that they overwhelm any kind of predators. That's still the theory, is it?
Yes, it's predator satiation. The periodical cicadas come up by the millions. A census for brood 13 done in the 70s found that for every acre of underground tree acreage, not open fields, the emergence was about 1.5 million per acre under trees.
So the point is that these creatures start crawling out. What's different in these past few years? You're doing a kind of crowdsourcing on studying this. You're able to get everyone involved and to let you know what's happening.
I do have the crazy idea that the 1.8 million people here in Southwest Ohio are part of my lab team. But crowdsourcing is not new for periodical cicadas. Back in the 1840s, a medical doctor started writing letters to newspapers saying, "I'm expecting the locust," which was what they called them in those days, "the locust to emerge in your part of the country. I'd appreciate it if your readers send me notice." And by the time he died in 1867, he had documented every known brood of periodical cicadas, not the full distribution, but that the broods existed. And so that crowdsourcing was picked up by the Department of Agriculture in 1902. They sent out 15,000 postcards, and they got 900 responses. So come 87, when Brood 10 emerged in Cincinnati, I just moved here, and I decided to put up a cicada hotline telephone line. And the first day they emerged, I had so many calls that first day, it broke the answering machine.
I guess because it's rare and it's impressive, people are very keen to share it with you.
Oh, I didn't realize that Cincinnati was such a bug-happy town. In 2004, the next time they came out, I didn't have the answering machine. I asked people to email me. The day that they started coming out in big numbers, I was getting an email a minute. It was just natural then that when the smartphones came out and were equipped with, this was the next quantum leap, because now I have a photograph that I can look at and verify that it's a periodical cicada. Second, the location is tied into their phone which is a GPS locator. I got longitude and latitude, date and time. So the quality of the data is dramatically better.
What are the biological questions? You're doing this crowdsourcing, you're getting people to contact you. You know, is it just cataloguing these things at the moment, or are there still bits of biology, you know, even genetics and so on that have to be done?
The work is never done. In fact, it'll never be done by any one generation. I'm following in the footsteps of my advisors and people from the previous century and the century before that. But to illustrate that there's still work to be done, back in 2001, I was alerted that there were cicadas emerging in part of southern Ohio and northern Kentucky where we didn't expect any. And in the process of investigating that emergence, I discovered a previously unrecognized 13-year cicada in northern Kentucky and the only 13-year periodical cicada in Ohio. And so there's still a lot of fundamental work to be done. But the distribution of these things and mapping them out is very important for several reasons. One, they help us monitor the state of their population. It's hard to believe, but there was one brood, Brood 11, went extinct in 1954.
Really?
And the biggest threat to periodical cicadas is deforestation because they reproduce in trees. And so the mapping helps us understand the state of the population. Also by mapping, it helps us understand how do periodical cicada broods change and evolve. I've now been able in my research to document the origin of a new brood 6 population here in Southwest Ohio. And that's one of the things we're expecting to see more often with climate change. The cicadas will emerge from the ground earlier than normal, or I should say in the past, because the soil temperature must be 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Because of that impact, we think that it might make cicadas miscount the years. And we see if that happens early, right after the eggs have hatched, that can cause some 17-year cicadas to come out after 13 years and establish essentially a new brood. Now, if you're asking about fundamental questions that are still to be answered, well, we now know how they detect the passage of time. What we don't know is how they remember what year it is.
From the sound of it, you've been studying this stuff all your academic career, maybe even before that, and you don't seem to have lost any enthusiasm.
Oh, no. This is my 50th year studying cicadas. I've got over probably 50,000 photographs of them, and I made a comment to my wife a few days ago that whoever has the most cicada photographs wins when they die.
So you're going to be a winner.
I'm trying.
Gene Kriske of Mount St. Joseph University in Indiana. The last time these two broods coincided, he says, was when Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States. We've put a link to his website on the Science in Action webpage, which you'll find at bbcworldservice.com. The other periodical brief emergence is that of the stinking lily or corpse flower, which is always a favourite for some reew when it erupts at Kew Botanical Gardens near London. Unexpected Elements' Marnie Chesterton was herself drawn this week by this unattraction.
Now, we've just got time at the end of this show to nip out to visit a special plant. Over at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, their largest Titum arum, or corpse flower, has just bloomed, and I'm heading over to see what all the fuss is about. And here it is. It's a couple of metres tall. It's quite hard to describe, but I feel like the Victorians would have disapproved of it. I mean, its Latin name is Amorphophallus, so that gives you some sense of what it looks like. There's basically a kind of what looks like one big red flower at the base and then this enormous yellow rod sticking out of it. With me is someone who can give me a more accurate description. Hello.
Hi, I'm Solène Ducquiret. I'm the manager of this glasshouse. The base is called the spathe, and it's like a big, large petal. And then protruding is the spadix. At the base of it, you've got a group of multiple little tiny flowers, which are separated between the male flower and the female flower. And then the protruding part is acting like a chimney, because it eats up, and it spreads the smell.
Okay, let's have a sniff. We're fighting our way through the crowds. So where do I go to sniff? Down here?
Just here.
Oh, okay, that's, yeah. Okay, imagine a lavatory that no one's cleaned for a long time.
Or just something that's been left at the back of the fridge and just kind of...
has been forgotten.
Yeah, that's bad.
So it's aiming to attract flies, which are its pollinator. So it smells really bad because flies are attracted by rotting flesh. It reproduces that smell. And this is also because that flowering specimen might be kilometres and kilometres away from the next flowering specimen. And therefore, it really needs to spread that smell and tell the fly, hey, come here, I'm also rotting flesh. And so the fly can leave the previous plant and bring the pollen to this plant.
Here at Kew, you've actually got other Titan arums, and there was one that went off quite recently, right?
This year we got lucky that two specimens decided to flower a week or two apart.
Because so it's quite rare, the flowering.
It only flower every maybe 6 to 7 years. It takes a lot of energy. And so for the next 7 years, it need to grow a leaf to gather energy from the sun through photosynthesis and bulk up that tuber again in order to be able to flower again.
So because you've had two Titan arums that have flowered so close together, what has that allowed you to do?
So that has allowed us to be a fly and collect the pollen, and then we store that pollen until this one decided to open.
You have cut a hole in the plant to get to the base where the flowers are, and basically you did sexual reproduction with a paintbrush.
Exactly. So we go with a paintbrush that we stick in our pollen pot, and then we just go there and brush against all the female flowers. In a few days, the huge chimney is going to collapse. Petal-like structure is going to rot down. But inside, you would have this group of seeds of fruits creating, and we love to wait for those to be ripe and turn red, and then we can harvest them and grow the next generation.
Can you eat them?
No.
Eat them? I don't know what makes Marnie's mind tick. Anyway, she's welcome to that assignment. I'll keep to more fragrant tasks. Meanwhile, Science in Action will be making its periodical return same time next week. Till then, from me, Ren Pease, and producer Ella Hummer at the BBC, thanks for listening.